Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to Dance Notes History. I've got a real treat for you today. I got Toby Green on the podcast. He's a British historian. He's senior lecturer in African history and culture at King's College London. He's just written the award-winning A Fistful of Shells. I wanted to catch up with him to ask about African history, largely sub-Saharan West African, Central West African history, in the years and the centuries leading up to the arrival of the Europeans on the scene and the beginning of the gigantic transatlantic trade in enslaved African peoples. It's a piece of history that we rarely cover on the podcast. It was an absolute treat to catch up with him and listen and learn from him. My own ignorance in the area was profound. This interview was filmed, as so many of our interviews are, and it will be going out on History Hit TV. It's the new Netflix for history. It's our new history channel. So please go and check that out. If you're listening to this podcast, you can use the code POD6, P-O-D-6. You get 6 weeks absolutely free of charge. What's going on at History Hit at the moment? We're planning the next few months and we're going to be busy. So looking forward to delivering all that new content. Lots of change going on. It's going to be fun. In the meantime, everyone, here is Toby Green. Enjoy.
Toby, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Dan. It's great to be here.
You've done a very unusual and strange thing, which is you've just written a giant, really important history book about a period of which and a place which that just we I now realize there was a yawning gap in English scholarship.
Yes, and well, did I write such a book? I don't know. I spent a lot of time, years really, wondering why the kind of history which I tried to write about in this book isn't better known. And I realize it's one of the reasons is what you say, that there just isn't that kind of accessible history which places West Africa in a context which, not only on its own terms, but which makes sense to a broader public, which is what I've tried to do in this book.
And the period you try and knit together pre-European contact West Africa with the opening moves of this. Well, no.
West Africa on its own terms, should we say, from like the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, which is where the book kind of starts in the early chapters, and how West Africa is beginning to, if you like, globalise.
That's right.
Even in that time, so even in the like 12th century, you were finding traders from Basra in Iraq in parts of West Africa.
I was struck by how global the history was right from the beginning.
Yes, and that's one of the things I think which some readers might find surprising in the book. That yes, in this book you'll find people from Basra and from Brazil you'll find West Africans trading in India and this is the kind of thing they'll come across in little places all the way through.
Yeah. Because again, with my terrible blinkered European point, I thought I was about to open a book that would be like reading about the Mesoamerican civilizations, and then suddenly the Europeans come and the whole thing falls apart. Mm-hmm. But in fact, from the opening pages, it's like, oh, you know, trade routes and gold circulating, and this felt like a part of the world that was very, very connected.
Yes, it was, and I think that is one of the important, I suppose, rebalancings that the book tries to do, that yes, this wasn't a region which somehow emerged into history in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries once the Europeans started trading down the West African coast and increasingly in slaves. It was a region which was already connected to parts of the Ottoman Empire, for example, to Saudi Arabia, to places like Iraq, to, and also interestingly connected to places in Spain and southern Italy even before the 15th century as well. So yes, it was a region which had important trading and political connections in its own right before then. That's right, and I think that. And that's something which persisted throughout the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries as well. You actually find diplomats from, for example, the Kingdom of Dahomey in Portugal or in Brazil in the 18th century. One of the bits which I found fascinating was when I found this document which described the ambassadors of the Kingdom of Dahomey in Lisbon in the 1790s, the bill at the restaurant where they ate. They went to the opera house every night for a month and this kind of thing. And it's not the impression that, if you like, school history syllabi have given us of West African history. That's one of the things that the book tries to look at.
But it does have a unique geographical position with advantages and disadvantages in terms of trade and state building that come from that. Like, tell me how do these empires and polities grow, flourish, and then decline in the space we now call West Africa?
Well, that's a very important question because the things which affect the rise and fall in a way of these empires and kingdoms relate to changing geographies, for example, and the expanding of dry seasons, which happens in the what we call the medieval period, but also from around 1630 onwards, that has a big impact on politics in the region. Also, elements of geography such as the savannah areas of West Africa, which are more open to being controlled by cavalries and so on, which allow for bigger states and regions nearer to the coast because of the different geography there, have different types of political formation. So all those things are relevant, as also are the openings which trade offers or closes in that period as well. And those do. So West African political systems arise on their own terms. But of course, like political systems all over the world, they're also related to other factors of trade and global connections.
And the Sahara, in terms of sailing, it was quite hard to sail between what we now call Morocco and West Africa, was it? But so it was, we're talking about trans-Saharan trade.
Yes, so to start with, you have this trans-Saharan trade, that's right. And for example, in 30 or 40 years ago, a lot of the history which was written about this, particularly in Portuguese, actually talked about the conflict between the caravel and the caravan. Okay. So you had the caravan, which obviously is the Saharan trade. And yes, there were very complex networks. There are maps from the 14th century, actually, which show these networks crisscrossing the Sahara through the oases and so forth. And then, yes, from the start of the 15th century, the Portuguese begin to sail down the coast of Morocco. They didn't actually have the navigational equipment, to the quadrants and such like, to make it easy to sail out of sight of land. That was one of the reasons. Once you sailed south of a particular cape, which was known as Cape Bojador at that time, you had to sail out of land to return to Portugal. That was one of the reasons that people didn't do that, because they were terrified of it. So it took quite a long time for the competition to really take shape between the caravan and the caravel. One of the things which is difficult, I think, with writing history over such a long period of time is that we can compress time. We can think, it was inevitable that in the course of the 15th century this would take place. Well, actually, at the time it wasn't inevitable at all. For people looking at it, 50 years in the future was a hell of a long time, as it is for us today. So I try to take account of that in the book too.
Does racism, bluntly, and the impact of and the shadow cast by the slave trade, where we think it's what technologically very sophisticated white people turning up and sort of dragging, natives out of the bushes with and then taking them against their wishes to the New World. Has that racist thinking allowed discourage us from looking at the kind of sophistication of the kingdoms and polities that have gone before?
Yes, clearly African history has always been thought, in Britain in particular, for about 200 years through the lens of the history of slavery since the abolition movement. In the abolition era, you had set up two obviously opposing camps. You had the pro-slavery movement, which portrayed Africa as a benighted continent, and slavery was saving these people from that continent. And then you had the abolitionists, who portrayed Africa also actually as a benighted continent, destroyed by the wars of the slave trade, and therefore you had to abolish slavery in order to ameliorate that. Of course, one of the ironies of that narrative is it set up an idea of African history as solely related to slavery, and it didn't allow any scope for any of the other elements of African history to come through, such as art, literature, oral and written, architecture, elements of technology and medicine, in fact, all of those things which you could write about and which there is evidence of, which weren't written about. And of course, the other irony is that these wars were very much an offshoot of the state-building process, just as they had been in Europe. Europe's state-building process in that period of history was also marked by innumerable wars and conflicts, just as was the case in Africa, which is one of the parallels which the book tries to look at.
And then in that case as well, why is it just a quirk of navigational technology? I mean, this is one of the big questions of history: is why on earth do these like Western Europeans, who've played no particular role in human history so far, go and expand like a virus across the entire world in the space of 100 years? Why was it that these African states, technologically advanced, culturally sophisticated, why did it prove so unequal?
That's a very good question. That's one of the reasons why the book looks at over a long period of time, because I think it's over a long period of time that you can get some answers to that question. To begin with, why was there an interest in that trade in the first place? We have to remember that the coast at that time, where the Portuguese arrived from the sort of mid 15th century onwards, were backwaters. They were provinces, sub-provinces of the centralized heart. So, for example, Senegal, which is where the Portuguese first arrived, the kingdoms around the coast there were provinces of the Empire of Mali, and
Mali would have faced north and east into the Arab world.
It was facing much more in those directions. That's right. And so, for the rulers, the viceroys of the provinces on the coast, it was to their advantage to trade with the Portuguese. They could begin to challenge and vie with the central power for supremacy, and that happened, for example, in Senegambia. It happened in the Kingdom of Congo as well, with the province in Soyo, and there are various different examples of that. So when we start breaking down our idea of Africa in quotes to the different constituent parts, that makes more sense as to why it was in some people's interests to begin trade, and then how did this trade mesh with a rise in inequality between African and European political actors? The book makes a case that one of the reasons for that is looking at this as a trade, looking at the history of money and how the types of money which were used in West Africa and which were traded by Europeans, so a lot of the early trade is in currencies, is in copper, iron, cowries, which are used as currencies in West Africa, and the value of those decline over time, whereas what Africa exported, which was gold to begin with, a lot of gold, and then subsequently captive labour, which was used to accumulate value in the Americas, grew over time. So that's the case that the book makes as to why that led to a rise in inequality.
And so when you look at these kingdoms, like the Kingdom of Mali, Kingdom of Congo, what are the sources like? How hard is it for a historian to push aside that curtain of that sort of that bookend of the slave trade and actually see what was going on before it?
Another very good question. It can be hard. It depends. The answer is different in different regions of West Africa. So Congo is a good case. So Congo, there's a huge amount of written sources. The Congolese kings and ruling royal families converted to Christianity very early. A lot of them became literate in Portuguese very early and wrote impassioned letters in Portuguese. And some of them also later in Kikongo from quite an early time. So we have those sources. And some of those recounted oral histories of the foundation of the kingdom from an early time too, but at that time in the late 1400s, in the 1500s. So for example, Congo is very well documented from that time. Mali, we have a lot of accounts in Arabic of Mali dating from the 13th century, 14th century, and more manuscripts are being found. We discussed before, actually, Dan, you've been to Timbuktu, you saw some of those, and there are more of those being found. And then there is a history in most of West Africa is an oral genre. It's retained orally, and sometimes, and I've had this experience myself, it's possible to corroborate oral and written sources from an early time, from the 16th century even, but that's a slow process.
This is After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark: Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And what are the boundaries of these West Africa? I mean, because with Western Europe, it's relatively straightforward. It's bounded by sea, and but with these West African kingdoms, what is the limit on their geographical expansion to the east and to the south?
That's important. Yes. It's often related to resources and accessibility, really. So the savannah is a key area. Most of the important kingdoms which arise in West Africa arise in the savannah region. So you have Mali, which arises partly in a savannah region. Oyo, for example, in southern Nigeria, arises in the savannah region. So often the spread of savannah grasslands and areas, therefore, which are quite both give you a lot of cultivable land, but also are easy to militarily control. That's very important.
Because it's easy to move large bodies of horsemen across.
That's right. Yeah. And cavalry was very important in West African warfare from an early times, from before when the Europeans arrived. And so those are important elements. And then the moving boundaries of the Sahara, I think, and how those affect trade routes to the north would be very important elements as well. And those do shift over time. As I say, there were dry periods in the medieval period that kind of seemed to have stopped in the middle of the 15th century, and there seems to have been a wetter period, but then became more significant, particularly in the 18th century. And some historians relate those dry periods to the increases in warfare which occurred then as well.
The breakdown of irrigation, things.
Yes, and then obviously harder to feed large populations and the discord that can provoke.
So when we're thinking about the arrival of Europeans, what did they were arriving into littoral areas and finding kind of willing accomplices who they realised that would
It's hard to generalise. I mean, one of the important things to remember about Europeans is what I think I write it well in the introduction to the book. One of the dangers of using just European sources is this idea that the Europeans were more important than they were. Of course, they were hugely important in some ways, but in other ways, most of them dropped dead within 6 months. The ones that survived, one of their survival mechanisms was really usually to form African families. They would marry locally, often with well-connected wives, and it was often the children of those unions who would then often become important traders and brokers, linking European ships as they arrived and African trading and political systems. So, so you could say, I suppose, when you say they found willing accomplices, in a way, you could say they helped to create, with their marriages with African people, trading classes who became important brokers and became willing accomplices. So that kind of creolized population was a very important part of the trade, and you find that in Senegal and Gambia. You find it on the Gold Coast in Ghana. You find it in various parts of West Africa.
Was West African society and politics more familiar than, say, Cortes found Aztec?
Yes,
and these are American.
I think in many ways they were. I think that, you can start with the arrival of the Portuguese in Senegambia in the 15th century. I mean, there's a shared language there. Arabic, Arabic is spoken in the Iberian Peninsula. It's also, Islam has reached Senegal by then, so you have, and Arabic becomes a shared lingua franca. And in fact, there seems to have been lingua franca between the Portuguese and West African peoples as far south as what's now Guinea-Bissau at that time. So that immediately obviously does create some kind of shared territory. There was a quite accurate map done in 1375 by a cartographer from Mallorca called Abraham Cresques of West Africa. So there was knowledge of West Africa in some parts of Europe before then. So I think that clearly, which obviously wasn't the case with Mesoamerica at all. So I think there were elements of commonality. And also an important thing to remember is one of the reasons the Portuguese started sailing down the West African coast, so they said, was to try and form an alliance with this mythical king, Prester John, a Christian king.
To get back to the Holy Land.
That's right. So there was a knowledge of, a sense that there were some areas in common for the 15th century.
We're so guilty of referring to West Africa as sort of West Africa. How politically diverse is it? Do you see the same in the period before Europeans arrived? Do you see the same, whether it's the Roman Empire or the Frankish Empire? Do you see these really big territorial units develop in the area we call West Africa?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, it depends on the period. You start to see them emerging, particularly from the 11th century onwards. You have the Empire of Ghana, as it was called, which is located, whose centre was in what's now Mauritania. And that controlled really quite a large area, including areas of what's now Senegal and Mali. Then you have the Empire of Mali, which arises in Mali and controls to the Atlantic coast areas of what would be now Burkina Faso, Timbuktu to the north on the Niger Bend. And then in the 15th century, you start getting some very important political changes before the Europeans arrive. So, for example, in northern Nigeria, what's now northern Nigeria, Kano becomes a really crystallizes its power at that time in Nigeria, and it's connected to areas really quite far south in Nigeria towards the Atlantic coast. And all of these, and you have in Burkina Faso, you have the rise of an empire called Mossi. You have a lot of changes in that time. What's driving those changes in the 15th century? Well, some people have said it might have been the impact of the Black Death in West Africa. Others have looked to shifting environmental patterns and shifting trade routes. But I think the key thing is these things are all happening internally directed in response to some of these changes. Before the Europeans arrive, it's not as if they're somehow in response to the Europeans. These are active systems when the Europeans arrive.
What about if you mentioned these empires and where they're centred? Why am I ignorant as to the archaeology left behind, the sort of heritage?
There are some fascinating monuments in West Africa. A lot of them are in ruins. I saw a talk a few years ago given by an archaeologist who'd worked in Burkina Faso on a huge ruins called Loropeni, which are virtually unknown outside Burkina Faso. And there's a number of those. I mean, for example, one of the main trading centres in the Gambia River region was at a place called Cantora, which was where the Atlantic system, where the Portuguese were trying to develop, met the Saharan system, and I know people quite well in Gambia. It's well known where this place is, so it's never been excavated. And so one of the causes of this is lack of funds for excavations in West Africa, in some ways also just the general way in which history as the distant African past is not really being prioritised either in or outside Africa actually.
Now, is that because it was deeply inconvenient for people to say that these cultures that in Africa were sophisticated, developed because of the rationale for slavery? We are going to take people against their will, we're going to enslave these people, and actually that's okay because they are incapable of self-rule, they're incapable of building the kind of institutions and political association that we have in Europe.
Yeah, from the European side, it didn't fit with the imperial myths, essentially. So it wasn't part of history as the textbooks were developed during the history of the European empires in Africa. I think since independence in Africa, various things. I mean, actually, in the 60s and into the 70s, there were in Nigeria, for example, at the University of Ibadan, and in Senegal, the University of Cheikh Anta Diop, there were really serious schools of historians working on that. But since the 80s, decline of funds available to universities in Africa, difficulties in conducting research, getting hold of visas to come and do research in European archives, all these things have tended to undermine the research into the distant African past in history departments in African universities. Although you do find this obviously in archaeology departments, but all of those factors have meant that even in Africa, history is a subject which has been in decline. In fact, for example, it was completely taken out of the secondary school syllabus in Nigeria for about 7 years until 2016. So that's sort of, in a way, that's another thing which in the end made me think that trying to write a book like this could be, you know, something which I ought to do, because it's not simply a case of Westerners haven't got access to this history. As I say, increasingly it's also the case actually in West Africa.
You mentioned Nigeria. There's going to be a billion more Nigerians in the next 40 years or something, I see from The Economist. So does this feel like a part of the world in which history, like in the way that Chinese people have been rediscovering their history and politicising their history and weaponising their history over the last 30 years. Are we going to see that, do you think, in West Africa? Is it going to be quite a dynamic time?
I think there's a possibility that it could, and I certainly hope that that's the case, because there's still a lot of work to be done. And as I say, it has been a subject which has been really under threat. I mean, as everywhere in the world, you know, STEM subjects are prioritised by governments, and that's certainly been also been the case in West Africa in the last 10 or 15 years. And also because, you know, when we look at some of the broader factors which today link West Africa to other parts of the world, and for example, the way in which European governments look at questions of migration and what's driving people to try and leave West Africa. Well, there are lots of reasons, but I think without a true sense of the deeper history of the African past, it's hard for people to not to think that somehow the future will be better somewhere else. And I think actually that sense of developing that awareness is actually really fundamental within education systems, not only for the African diaspora, say, in Europe, but also in West Africa itself.
I'm afraid I'm going to ask you this question. It's really mean to end up with, but I get asked really actually increasingly now when I do public events about returning treasures, quote unquote, that were looted or bought or purchased or any got in any way and stuck in British museums. And for some, we think almost West Africa is, we think of that as an area probably that suffered more than most in terms of the loss of its portable antiquities. What is your sense, and when you're out there working, I mean, do you think that there is going to have to be some, is the physical, not just the archaeology of the places, the archival stuff, but are the physical objects going to be really important in that story? And are we going to face increasing pressure to send them back?
You can tell so many stories from an object. Funnily enough, I was at a meeting at the British Museum this morning where we went to the African ruins. In that meeting, we talked precisely about all the stories that some of the objects in the African ruins of the British Museum can tell. You know, if those objects aren't present in the areas where they originated from, there are fewer stories which can be told and fewer ways for young people there to connect with some of the things I was talking about. So I think clearly that has to be the direction of the travel into the future. And I'm sure that if, as you said, and as may be an aspiration, history does become more important within the way in which education systems develop in West Africa, that's going to be a demand which we see more and more of.
Well, in the meantime, they got your book.
Okay.
Which is, and is this book being, is it receiving a big audience in West Africa as well as?
Well, a friend wrote to me from Gambia to say that the main bookshop in Gambia had already sold out. So that was encouraging. Wow. So I hope so.
Well, I'm sure lots of West Africans listen to this podcast who will snap it up now as well. Thank you very much, Toby Green. A Fistful of Shells. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. Thank you, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.